And remember that essentially we thought of the manifold as being obtained or defined through maps to ordinary flat space. Okay? And so this is the fundamental definition of a manifold. And it's always important to have that picture in mind, that even though we think about a manifold as a smooth surface, that sort of like a rubber sheet or something, the way we really define the manifold involves thinking about its being mappable to flat space locally. And this is important for the topology of the manifold and also for defining calculus on the manifold. Now, because this course is short, I am not going to continue down the mathematical path, because if you really try to define everything, I showed you at the end, if you try to define the derivative of a function, it involves these three maps, right? I have to, so what is the function mapping a manifold M to a manifold N? And I want to define its derivative, so I map both M and N to flat space. And then I define a function from one flat space to the other flat space. And then I can define the derivative down there. So it's very complicated. You have to take care of all these maps and so on. Now, in practice, you never use that, okay? And if you do, you would just have huge long formulae for all the maps and so on. In practice, you can do without it. And you just work within a coordinate system. But keep in mind that the whole definition of a manifold involves the possibility of introducing many different coordinate systems and changing from one to another freely. So this is the kind of paradox that when actually you do calculations in general relativity, you don't need to worry about the fundamental mathematical definitions at all. You just need to chug away at your formulae in a particular coordinate system. And so many of the most, so the way in which mathematicians work in this field is typically that when they actually try to show things or prove things, they do it in coordinate systems. And then when they come to write it up for publication, they transform it into a form where it looks like it's independent of coordinates. Okay? And there are many, many examples of this. So if you want to really do things, in this subject and do calculations and discover things, in practice, you're just going to end up working in some coordinate system. So for that reason, I'm just going to short-circuit all of that mathematical definition. But I do encourage you to read Carroll's notes because he gives you, it's a very clear account, basic account. For example, when we think of our manifold as some curved surface, we want to think of not just points on the surface, we want to think of vectors on the surface. So at every point on the manifold, you can have vectors pointing in any direction. And the space of all these vectors is the tangent space at the point P. Okay, and so again, if you read Carroll's notes, he'll give you the definition of a vector. The actual definition of a vector is coordinate independent. I mean, a vector is a real geometrical object that should not depend on the coordinates you use. But to define that, you have to define a basis at each point for all the vectors and so on. And I'm not going to get into that because it's essentially just mathematical definitions which you will not use in practice. And I just encourage you to read about it because, and it is important because it'll tell you what you're actually dealing with when you do these calculations, okay? Similarly, the definition of the dual vector space. And the formal mathematical definition is rather abstract. The dual vector space is the space of functions, linear functions of vectors that give numbers, okay? And that's the correct definition, but I'm actually just going to use tensors with raised and lowered indices because that's actually what you will use for calculations. All right? And so again, I advise you to read Carol on the mathematical background, but I'm just going to plunge straight ahead with the definitions you need to really do calculations. So let's discuss. So we have TP, and then we also have TP dual. This is the dual vector space. So these are vectors, which are very intuitive. The vectors on a manifold are just little arrows that you can put at any point. The dual vectors are these linear functions of the vectors which map a vector to a scalar, to a number. And just read Carol. On manifold, which will allow us to go ahead rapidly and do calculations. So the most primitive kind of tensor on a manifold, we've dealt with tensors, right? The F alpha beta, the A alphas, the J alphas, these are all tensors in special relativity. But now we're going to do tensors on manifolds, on curved spaces. And we'll see how the Lorentz transformation generalizes to a more general transformation, more general change of coordinates. So the simplest kind of tensor is a scalar. So I should think of my manifold. I've got some point at P, and then I've got some coordinate system. So these coordinate lines are, of course, just the grid in my coordinate system. And so that point gets mapped, P gets mapped to the point X of P. Okay. Let's call it X mu of P. X point X mu. And then, of course, now we can define functions because these are just numbers. And so we can have a function phi of X mu of P. And just be slightly careful. When I introduce something like this as the argument of a function, there are no indices here, right? Phi is a scalar quantity. All I mean by this, this doesn't have an external index. This just, the X mu literally means T, X, Y, Z. Okay, it's a function of those four variables. Okay, so a scalar quantity, how does it change under coordinate transformations? So let's have one coordinate chart where we call the coordinates x, and then we had another coordinate chart. So this was u and u prime or whatever, two different coordinate systems for the manifold. And they might overlap at the point P. And the definition of a scalar is very simple. The scalar is just some number associated with this point. Every point will have some value of the scalar associated with it. And so it should obviously be true that that phi prime which I'll call phi prime of x prime of p, this means the value of the coordinates associated with p in the primed coordinate system, okay? Well, it should just equal the value of phi associated with x of p in the original coordinate system. So I should just think of my manifold as some surface, and every point of the surface, it has some value for this function phi. And if I change coordinates, I don't change the value of the function associated with any point. I just change the coordinates associated with any point. Okay, so that's the simplest kind of tensor, and we'll just write this kind of notation that when I change coordinates, the value of the function at the new coordinate equals the value of the function at the old coordinate. Okay. Let me, in fact, rotate them. The next most next interesting quantity is called a contravariant vector. And the way to think about this is that it's really the direction of a derivative at a point. So a contravariant vector is a collection of numbers which together specify the direction you're going to take the gradient in on the manifold. So let's write it down. V mu of x d by dx mu. Okay, so that is a linear combination of the derivatives in t, x, y, z. And if I want to picture that, here's my manifold. This guy is telling me take the gradient in a direction specified by those four numbers. Okay? And that's what the definition of a contravariant vector is. And so we could call that v. See, it's some quantity without indices. That suggests it should be independent of the coordinate system. And so if I work out v prime, what is this v in the new coordinate system? Well, actually, it's the same. So v is equal to v mu prime of x prime d by dx prime mu. And that should just be the same as v mu of x d by dx mu. But d by dx prime, I can work out by the chain rule. This is nothing but dx alpha dx prime mu d by dx alpha, right? If I have a function, so you can think of x prime as a function of x when you change coordinates. Likewise, you can think of x as a function of x prime. That'll be the inverse function. And we're going to assume these coordinate transformations are all one-to-one and invertible. Okay, so given that you know what the new coordinates are as functions of the old, you know what the old ones are as function of the new. And so what this means is differentiating with respect to x prime, I can just express the quantity in terms of I can express the quantity in terms of x of x prime, and then if I differentiate, differentiating with respect to x prime is just the same as differentiating first with respect to x, and then multiplying by the derivative of x with respect to x prime. And so we infer from this that v mu prime, the components of a vector in the new coordinate system are just dx prime mu dx alpha times v alpha of x. So that's the transformation law of a covariant vector. And I did it just for the derivative, but that's the general definition. So something is a contravariant vector if it transforms like that as we go from one coordinate system to the other. How do I get that blackboard? It's not moving, is it? There we go. Okay. Now, a covariant factor okay, and if you want to remember the names, contravariant has TR, so it's like a tree, and a tree goes up. But covariant has a V, so it's a valley, which goes down. Okay. Covariant vectors, an example is, so this is just an example. When I said direction of the derivative at a point, that's an example of a contravariant vector. So an example is the gradient of a scalar. Okay, so how do I compute the gradient of a scalar? Well, just d by dx mu of some function of x. So that's a quantity with four indices. And you see, I mentioned there was this business about the tangent space and the dual tangent space. And the dual vectors, the covariant vector is dual to the contravariant vector. And as I said, that means it's a linear function giving real numbers from any vector. But if I took this guy and I just multiply it by v mu, which is my contravariant vector, voila, I have a real number. Okay? So that's how it actually works. That's how this mathematical definition works. But you can just take this simple point of view that a covariant vector is something with a downstairs index. This is an example of it. And let's call this w mu of x. And so if I work out w mu prime of x prime, that's w mu in the primed coordinate system. Well, I know phi of x equals phi of x prime, so I can put that in. And I know d by dx prime mu. Maybe just let me reiterate. When I work out something in the primed system, I just prime everything. Okay, that's the rule. So prime this, prime that, everything is primed. Now I know what phi prime is. Phi prime of x prime is phi of x. And I know how to convert derivatives with respect to x prime into x derivatives. So this is dx alpha dx prime mu d by dx alpha phi of x. And that's equal to dx alpha dx prime mu w alpha. Okay, so what's happened is that w transforms in the opposite way to the v. The covariant vectors transform with the opposite transformation to the contravariant ones. So the definition of a covariant vector is simply something which transforms like this, w mu prime of x prime equals dx alpha w alpha of x. And this is also called a dual vector. In fact, it's also called a one-form. It's called a covector. And this is called a vector. And in fact, you'll notice that this is just like Lorentz transformations, okay, where this guy is the analog of the lambda mu prime alpha, right? And this one is the analog of the lambda twiddle alpha mu prime. Okay, except it's more general, because this is not just a matrix. This could be any function of x or x prime. And so it's just a generalization of these. But just as these were inverses of each other, you can see this is actually the inverse of that, because NB, dx, the matrix there, dx alpha, dx prime mu, if I multiply by dx prime nu dx alpha, so I'm multiplying these two matrices together by contracting these indices, that's equal to dx prime nu, just by the chain rule, dx prime mu, and that's just delta nu mu. See, if I differentiate T prime with respect to X prime, I get 0. T prime with respect to T prime gives 1. X prime with respect to X prime gives 1. And so that's just delta mu nu. There's of course a whole bunch of other notation which is sort of buried here. You should always bear in mind that a partial derivative here means keep all the other coordinates fixed, right? So d by d x naught means keep x1, x2, x3 fixed, and so on. And similarly, a tensor of valence Mn, and if you don't remember the word valence, just remember it's telling you how many upstairs indices and how many downstairs indices. And these tensors are objects which live simultaneously in the tangent space at a point and in the cotangent space, the TP star. They're these two spaces. And so these tensors transform in the obvious way that alpha, beta, gamma, let's say there are m of those indices, and then mu nu, let's say there are n of those indices. So t prime of x prime is equal to dx prime alpha dx rho, and then a whole bunch of similar terms. There are m of those, and then dx psi dx prime mu, there are n of those, and then t rho xi. Okay, so every upstairs index gets one of these factors, every downstairs index gets one of those factors contracted with it, and that gives you the tensor in the primed coordinate system. And just a bit of notation that the rank of a tensor is defined to be m plus n, just the total number of indices. Ah, I wrote on one that can't go up and down. Sorry about that. I didn't write much on it anyway. Now I've lost the eraser. So then there are some basic facts about tensors. Sorry? Oh, sorry. No problem. Let me see if I can. There we go. Okay. No problem. I'll work over here because I messed up over there. The trick is never to use the back one. Sorry, I'm new to this. Right, so there are some rules of tensor algebra. So if T and S are tensors, then 1 T plus S is a tensor. Tensors of the same valence, then T plus S is a tensor. Right, because they're both going to transform with the same overall factor here. And so if you add them together, the sum still transforms with that factor. The transformation rule is linear. Two, there's a rule called outer multiplication, okay, so T alpha beta dot 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 T S mu nu dot dot dot. In fact, I didn't say this very well. Let me just rewrite this. T and S are tensors. Then this one is only valid if T and S have the same valence. But the other ones are more general. Outer multiplication, so you just multiply the two tensors together, you now have lots more indices. You have the sum of the ranks. Okay, so if there was R indices here and S indices here, you have R plus S, rank R plus S. And that's obviously a tensor too. And then three, contraction. Contraction takes a tensor to a tensor. So if I contract T alpha beta gamma dot 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 with S alpha mu nu dot dot dot, so I just contract two of these indices, then this guy, this has rank R plus S minus 2. So these are kind of very obvious facts about tensor, that you can multiply them, you can add them, and obtain other tensors. A very useful fact. Okay, which sounds trivial, but is very powerful, and we'll use it again and again, that if a tensor is zero in one coordinate system, then it is zero in all coordinate systems. Okay, so even though the value of a tensor can be changed, by these coordinate transformations like this. The actual numbers in the tensor will completely change when you do coordinate transformations. If it was zero, then it's not going to change. And essentially the goal, if you want to write down a theory which is invariant under coordinates, which works in all coordinate systems, you simply have to formulate it in terms of an equation, which is a tensor equation, which equals zero. Because if that tensor equals zero in one coordinate system, it'll be zero in any coordinate system. Okay, so these will be the building blocks of general relativity. And so let me begin with the most important tensor, which is the metric. And as the name implies, it's what you use to measure distances. Minkowski space. Has a line element. This means a Lorentz invariant distance squared, which we've already seen, ds squared. Ds squared is just d tau squared with a minus sign. So it's the minus c squared dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And the statement of Lorentz invariance is that if I use this formula, just which is basically just Pythagoras' rule in spacetime, if I use this formula to work out the distance between any two points, nearby points, then that distance will be exactly the same in any coordinate system. And of course, we wrote that in this way, eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. And this eta quantity is the metric, is the Minkowski metric. So when we go to a curved spacetime, it's a simple generalization of the same idea where the distance squared between any two points separated. So you can think of, let's say, one point at x mu and another point at x mu plus dx mu. And we're calculating the distance between those two points. And the distance between those two points is given by the metric g mu nu of x alpha, let's say. As I mentioned before, I'm just putting an index on this alpha to in this argument to indicate this is really ct x, y, z. The metric is a function of these three things, but this is not a free index. Times dx mu dx nu. So it's just like the Minkowski line element, but the matrix which enters here is not minus 1, 1, 1, 1. It's just completely general, almost completely general symmetric matrix. So let me tell you a little bit more about that, the conditions on that matrix. Sorry, this is getting annoying. I'm gonna stick with this one. Sorry? Yeah, I guess then you have to figure out. Yeah, I guess you have to figure it out each time. Maybe it's better. Yeah, you're right. Especially, let me put that one right at the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just leave it there.
So. All right, good idea.
Now, it's the,
now the front one has to come.
One.
Okay. Fine. Oh no, I need
no,
the.
You're missing the red.
Yay. Thank you. Okay, thanks a lot. Right, so what is G mean U of X? So this is a general 4x4 symmetric non-degenerate matrix at each x. With three positive and one negative eigenvalue. And this is called pseudo-Riemannian. So Riemann was interested in spaces which are locally Euclidean space, Rn. But in physics, we're interested in spaces which are locally Minkowski space. And the difference is that we want spaces that locally, where the metric has locally one negative eigenvalue, to be like time, and three positive. If this is the case, then it looks like locally like four-dimensional Minkowski space. So to show you that, let's just write this out, that quantity out, at one point. So that's a symmetric 4x4 matrix. So I can diagonalize it, right? So I diagonalize it with an orthogonal transformation. So that will be I'll just write it in matrix notation. I won't bother with the indices. So diagonal O so that's going to be dx transpose O transpose diagonal O dx. Won't bother with the indices. So I'm just writing my symmetric matrix as an orthogonal transformation of a diagonal matrix. And then the point is that this matrix has to take the form minus lambda 0, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, with the lambda i's positive, right? Because G is non-degenerate, so its eigenvalues cannot vanish by assumption. And three are positive and one is negative, so it must look like this. But if it looks like this, then I can write it, the lambdas are positive, so I can write it as minus L naught squared plus L1 squared plus L2 squared plus L3 squared. And in that case, this is L transpose. If I invent the matrix L, which is just diagonal, L0, L1, L2, L3, this is L transpose eta L. Okay? So let's just absorb the L. So this is so this is equal to dx transpose O transpose L transpose eta L O dx. And that I'll just define to be dy, eta dy. Okay, so y dy is equal to L O dx. And so obviously, at a point, I can change coordinates from x to y just by this formula. Okay. So if I had my coordinates x, I just define some new coordinates, y equal to LOX. And then the differential of these dy dx is just this, this LO. And that coordinate transformation will change the metric from any form to Minkowski. So providing you satisfy this condition that given here, then there exists a coordinate system which at that point in which, at that point, the metric is just the Minkowski metric. So this is given the name, the principle of equivalence. Okay, which is the foundation of Einstein's theory of gravity, which is that at every space-time point, it is possible to choose a coordinate system which will be called a free fall or locally inertial coordinate system. Such that within a sufficiently small neighborhood, the laws of physics take the same form as they do okay, so what that tells you is that if you want to describe gravity, Einstein's theory is a theory of gravity, all you have to do is know what the laws of physics in the absence of gravity are, which is the special relativistic laws of physics, and then you write down those laws using a metric, g mu nu, in place of eta mu nu, and if you do that, then the laws will automatically satisfy the equivalence principle. Okay, so Einstein's theory of gravity is essentially that this g mu nu contains gravity. And to go from a theory without gravity to one with gravity, all you do is replace eta mu nu with g mu nu. So why did he reach this amazing conclusion? And Einstein himself describes this as the greatest moment of his life. He was sitting in his chair, and suddenly he realized he could not tell the difference between gravity pulling him down into the chair or somebody accelerating the chair upwards with no gravity being there. He couldn't tell the difference. Okay. In other words, gravity is just the same as gravity can be simulated by being in a situation where the coordinate system attached to the observer is accelerating. You cannot distinguish between acceleration and the form and the force of gravity. And the acceleration is all to do with this this metric. Later, we'll sharpen this slightly. So all I've shown you really is that at one point, I can choose coordinates in which g is eta for any g satisfying those conditions. But later, we'll sharpen this statement slightly. That g min u equals eta, so it's possible to choose a coordinate system. Possible to choose a coordinate system such that g min u equals eta min u at a point, and the first derivative of the metric is also zero. Okay, so if I write my laws of physics in such a way that they are coordinate invariant, I can, by a coordinate transformation, turn this g into eta at one point, and I can also arrange the first derivative of the metric as zero at one point. And so the force of gravity will actually reside in the second derivatives of the metric, which you can't set equal to zero in general, and those will be called the Riemann curvature. So now let's discuss a little bit about coordinate transformations of the metric.
One question.
Sure.
What is the difference between it being the derivative being zero or being in a flat space?
Sorry?
If the derivative of the metric are zero, automatically you are in a flat space, right?
If what is zero?
If the derivative of the metric are zero.
Yes.
So it will be just the derivatives are zero, and then you are in a flat space by construction.
No, we have some point, and we can choose a coordinate system around that point such that g equals eta at this point. Now, we can also adjust the coordinate system here so that actually the first derivative equals zero at p. Okay, just at one point. So g is a function, okay, of the coordinates whose derivative happens to be zero just at that one point. But away from that point, the derivative is not zero.
Yeah, but I'm asking if these conditions are not the same condition.
No. Being flat is, so you should worry about the second derivatives. Okay? If the second derivatives are zero, if the second derivatives are zero at every point, then it's really flat. Obviously, if second derivative is zero, let me see. If I can choose, so basically what happens is this is the non-trivial one. So when I draw this curve, the first derivative is zero, but the second is not zero. The statement will be that through changes of coordinates in the vicinity of one point, I can set the metric to, or at one point, I can set the metric to eta, I can set its first derivative to zero, but I cannot set this to zero. I can set some of these to zero, but not all of those. And the ones that are not zero, this is called the Riemann curvature. And that's where gravity comes from. Okay? So if you think about a sphere, it's kind of obvious, right? I've got a sphere, and let's say at the North Pole. I can work in coordinates of the sphere, in coordinates on the sphere, where near the North Pole, it just looks like a piece of flat space. If I'm looking at a region whose size is smaller than the radius of the sphere, then the piece of space will look just like flat space. But as I go away from that point, the curvature will become obvious. We'll do some examples. Now I... So the behavior of the metric under a coordinate transformation is 0, 2. It's a tensor of valence 0, 2, no upstairs indices, 2 downstairs indices, and so we have g prime mu nu of x prime is equal to dx alpha dx beta dx prime mu dx prime mu g alpha beta of x. And so if you take this equation, first thing you can do with it is calculate the determinant of the metric. Determinant of G prime. It's a 4x4 matrix. And so its determinant is the determinant of dx dx prime squared times det G. And so what does that tell you? It tells you that the square root... Now, remember, this determinant of G is negative, because the determinant is the product of the eigenvalues, and 1 is negative and 3 are positive. So det G is definitely negative. So we can take the square root of det G if we put a minus sign in front of it. Det G prime is equal to... Now, that's a positive quantity, so... So that is the Jacobian. Okay, the Jacobian by definition is the determinant of the coordinate transformation between x and x prime, and times root minus det g. And so what this means is that root minus det g prime times d4x prime is equal to root minus det g times d4x. Okay, so we call this quantity is the invariant volume element, which is to say, if I calculate that quantity, root minus g d4x, I'll get the same answer in any coordinate system. Yep.
When you say Jacobian, you mean like the absolute value of the Jacobian?
No, the what I mean is when I have an integral and I change from one, okay, that's the Jacobian.
Yeah, but it has to be positive. No?
Has to be?
Positive. No? Or not necessarily, because like since we took this square root of the square.
Yeah, this has to be positive. Why is it positive? Well, it has to be invertible, dx prime dx, and... So definitely it's not zero, but you see, if the determinant of dx prime dx, yeah, this gets us in a little further afield, but coordinate transformations which change orientation of a manifold will have determinant dx prime dx not positive. Okay. So normally we won't have to worry about that. So we will actually assume that det dx prime dx is positive. It's definitely not zero because that's an invertible. The coordinate transformation is always invertible, and that means that that matrix has to have an inverse. But in fact, the ones that flip sign correspond to changes of orientation of the coordinate system. So I won't worry about that. So other properties of the metric. I'm on the middle one. Thanks, Annette. Really works. You just have to calculate every time. Okay. The inverse metric. So that is a G mu nu with upstairs indices, and that is a tensor defined by G mu nu G nu alpha equals delta mu alpha. So it's literally the matrix inverse of G. And the transformation rule of the inverse, it is a tensor, and so it transforms as dx prime mu, dx prime mu, dx alpha, dx beta, g alpha beta, x, x prime. And we can use the metric to raise or lower indices. T alpha mu nu equals G alpha beta T beta mu nu, etc. So we already did this when we did electromagnetism. We had the F alpha beta with lowered indices and we raised it with the eta. We just do the same with the metric. So an example. So let's take a two-sphere. So that is a Riemannian manifold, has a positive definite metric. This has so this is locally R2, locally Euclidean manifold, and of course we can embed it within three-dimensional Euclidean space. And so we just write x is sine theta. So the definition of the two-sphere, of course, is that x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. So I write x is sine theta cos phi, y is sine theta sine phi, z is cos theta. And now these coordinates, theta and phi, cover the two-sphere with some problematical points, as we mentioned before. And that describes the embedding of S2 in E3. And now we can calculate the metric. And so in this case, there's a natural metric which exists in the three-dimensional space. And so if you've got two points on the sphere, why not use that metric to calculate the distance? And so this is, we can just do that. So the metric in Euclidean space is this one. And if I substitute in these formulae, so the dx is, just to do an example, the dx will be cos theta cos phi d theta plus differentiating the cos phi, I get sine theta, actually with a minus sign, sine phi d phi, etc. So I leave you to work out all of these d's, the dx, dy, and dz, in terms of d theta and d phi. And when you do that, you find that it's d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And so we say, i.e., the metric on the two-sphere is 1 in the theta direction, and or g theta, theta is 1. It's 0 in the off-diagonal, and it's sine squared theta in the phi phi direction. Okay, so this is theta phi theta phi. So root g, in this case, I'm a Riemannian manifold, so the metric has two positive eigenvalues at every point, and the determinant is positive. So to construct the invariant volume element, I don't need this minus sign. I just take root g, and that gives me sine theta. So the volume element is sine theta d theta d phi. And we know that very well from ordinary vector calculus. Oops. Actually, I'll leave that in. And so I'll just leave you as an exercise, work out the metric in stereographic coordinates. For the two sphere, remember we had those coordinates, north pole coordinates or south pole coordinates, and just work out that dx squared is equal to 4 dz1 squared plus dz2 squared over 1 plus z1 squared plus z2 squared squared. And that's equal to 4 over 1 plus r squared squared. So r squared here is just the radius in the plane. Times the r squared plus r squared d phi squared. And phi is just the polar angle or azimuthal angle. So in this case, we could get the metric on the two-sphere just by using the fact that actually the two-sphere can be embedded in three flat dimensions. And in the three flat dimensions, there's a natural distance defined just by Pythagoras' theorem. In fact, there is a theorem which is due to John Nash. You may have seen the film, A Beautiful Mind. And so one of the theorems that he proved was a surprising one, that every manifold, every actually Riemannian Riemannian means that all the eigenvalues of the determinant are positive. Can be isometrically embedded in Euclidean space, in a Euclidean space. Of some dimension. Okay, so every manifold you could think of can always be thought of as living in a flat Euclidean space of some dimension.
One question.
Yep.
What is the upper bound of the dimension?
The theorem doesn't tell you. There's some dimension. Four-dimensional space-time, it's interesting to know that four-dimensional space-time, Minkowski space, can always be locally embedded in 10 dimensional Minkowski spacetime. That's another theorem. This theorem is not really important in anything we'll do.
Did you mean Minkowski in Euclidean or?
No, when I'm talking about a pseudo-Riemannian manifold with minus plus plus plus, any four-dimensional pseudo-Riemannian manifold can be embedded in a 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime. Okay, so I'll give you another example. I don't want to use that middle one. Nope. Front. Sorry. Oh no, this is the right one. Okay. Another example, I already gave it to you, De Sitter space, right? So De Sitter space was minus x naught squared plus x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus x4 squared equals 1. That was the definition of De Sitter space, De Sitter. In four-dimensional Minkowski space, a five-dimensional Minkowski space, right? So just as I've done this sphere in three-dimensional flat space, I did an S2, do De Sitter 4, okay, in five-dimensional Minkowski space. And the exercise is work out the metric. Of De Sitter space, in four-dimensional De Sitter space. Okay? And that is the metric to which our universe is heading. Okay? So it's a very important metric. And I'm just going to leave you to play around with this. You have to decide. You see, what we did in the sphere is we chose, I don't know where it went now, but we, here it is. We expressed x, y, and z, the embedding coordinates, in the Euclidean space, in terms of, we had three embedding coordinates, but we solved for them in terms of two coordinates, such that this constraint is always satisfied. Okay, so just do the same over there. Find four coordinates, such that these all of these five x's are functions of those four coordinates, and the four coordinates are completely unconstrained. And then take the line element in this space, which is just minus dx naught squared plus dx1 squared plus dx2 squared, etc. Compute it in terms of the new coordinates. and you'll get the metric on De Sitter space. Right. Do I have another 10 minutes, 5 minutes? You okay? Take a deep breath. Actually, I need a deep breath. Is this this week is a nightmare. Okay. So, but you have to absorb how amazing this is. You've got this whole force of gravity in the world, and Einstein's understanding or insight is that it's not really there. Locally, there is no gravity. You just pick coordinates and bang, gravity disappears from the story. Gravity is only there because space-time has curvature, and so it will come into the second derivatives. Second, you know, if we do a Taylor expansion of anything around a point, the leading term is a constant, then I have the first derivative term, second derivative. So the leading term and first term are all that matters locally. And at that level of approximation, there really is no gravity. So gravity, in a sense, you see, is from the beginning non-local. Gravity doesn't exist locally. Gravity only exists because space is sort of, if what I mean by locally is the value of a function and its first derivative, gravity doesn't come into physics there. It only comes in the second derivative, in the curvature of space-time. Okay, so now we have a very important idea, which is the connection. And the problem is that we express the laws of physics as differential equations. And so the question is, how can I take derivatives of tensors? So the first thing to try is just to see if you take the derivative of a tensor, is it still a tensor? And we'd like to write the laws of physics involving only tensors so that they will be valid in any coordinate system. So start off with a scalar. Okay, if we differentiate a scalar, this is indeed a tensor. And it's valence 0, 1. So that's good. No problem with differentiating a scalar. We get a tensor, and that behaves properly. But can we differentiate higher rank tensors and get scalars? So let's calculate d. But d by d x prime mu of v prime alpha of x prime. So I'm working out the derivative of a vector, contravariant vector, in the primed coordinate system. And I want to know, is this equal to just that matrix dx prime dx to the one for each of these indices times the same thing in the original coordinate system. So what is this given by? Well, the derivative, I can use the chain rule to write it this way, d by dx beta. So that's just d by dx prime mu. And then I can express v prime in terms of v by dx prime alpha dx mu v mu of x
maybe mu isn't the best.
Mu is not the best. Thank you for being so polite. So now I have to differentiate this stuff with respect to x. So that's fine. X prime is a function of x. This is dx prime dx. I can happily differentiate it again. I'll just get another function of x. And clearly, I get two terms. So I differentiate this one, or I differentiate that one. So the first term is dx beta dx prime mu. And then I have d2x prime alpha dx beta dx nu, v nu. And then I have dx beta dx prime mu, dx prime alpha dx nu, x nu, dv nu, dx beta. Okay, so the second term is exactly right. Okay, so this is good for a 0, 2 tensor. Sorry, it's actually 1, 1. That's the correct transformation rule for a 1, 1 tensor. You have dx, dx prime on the lowered index and dx prime dx on the upper index. But this stuff, this is all wrong. Okay, so in other words, a derivative of a vector is not a tensor. So this was the ingenious thing that Riemann solved in 1830 in his PhD thesis, okay, in Germany. I think it was 1830. Riemann figured out how to solve this problem and how to define derivatives of tensors on manifolds. And you do it by define the connection gamma mu nu alpha with the transformation law . So it looks a real mess, and that's why it was such a great discovery to find it. And I'll tell you what's really remarkable about it, and it's not in most textbooks. Okay, so the first part of it is obvious. The connection transforms as a tensor. That's the first part of its transformation. But the second part is these second derivatives. And so I'm going to write this as J mu alpha. So J is the analog of lambda in special relativity. It's dx prime dx. But the J is really a function of x, right? This is the inverse matrix, so it's J twiddle beta nu, J twiddle gamma rho, gamma alpha beta gamma, plus J mu lambda d rho prime J twiddle lambda nu.
This definition that you have d2x by mu by d2x lambda.
Oh, sorry, you're right. Thanks. Sorry?
Oh, yeah.
Is it okay? Okay, and now, but notice we have this formula that dx prime mu dx lambda dx lambda dx prime rho is delta mu rho. Okay, so the chain rule says that is just dx prime dx, and dx prime dx is just delta. Sorry, dx prime is just delta. And so I can actually differentiate this formula to show that d2x prime mu dx, sorry. Let's differentiate this formula. We get dx prime mu dx lambda. So I'm actually going to differentiate this guy first. I'm going to take d by dx prime of this formula. And I'll get d2x lambda dx prime nu dx prime rho. So I've just taken d by dx prime of that term. And I should add d by dx prime of this term. But I'll take d by dx prime by writing d by dx prime as dx dx prime d by dx, and then operate on this term. When you do that, you'll get this identity, dx dx prime rho lambda dx alpha dx prime nu d2x prime mu dx alpha dx lambda. And so this term here, okay, the second term here, can actually be re-expressed as this term. See, so what I did, just to summarize, I took d by dx prime of this formula. I got two terms on the left-hand side. I got zero on the right-hand side, because this is independent of x prime. This is just ones and zeros. And then I obtained this identity. So I can replace this second term with this term. And so that I could write as minus J twiddle lambda rho J twiddle alpha nu, and then d alpha of J mu lambda. Okay, so this piece here could be used to replace that one. Okay, so there are two forms of this transformation law, which are just equivalent. And depending on the situation, it'll be useful to use one or the other. So then I will leave it as an exercise, show that d mu v nu, which is the derivative plus gamma. So the point of this connection is you take the derivative index and you put it last on the bottom of the gamma. You take the vector index. You're trying to recover something which has an upstairs vector index, so it's got to go there. Gamma only has one upstairs index. And then gamma has another index, so you better contract that one with the vector. And show that this quantity is a tensor. Okay, so how are you going to do it? You see, the problem with that derivative, the ordinary derivative, partial derivative of a vector, is I got that second term, the first term, second derivatives of x prime, which is wrong. But the transformation of gamma is designed so that the second term here, when I use this identity, actually has the second derivatives of x prime in it, with a minus sign, okay, and that will precisely cancel the bad term over there. And so this quantity will transform only with the second term as a tensor. So this just cancels the bad term. So the transformation cancels the bad term. Okay, so this looks kind of ugly. So you just introduced this quantity and designed its transformation so that it would cancel the bad term. Doesn't sound terribly profound. And in fact, it's not really explained in books why, or most books. It is explained in that little blue book, which is one of the reasons I like it, why this was such a great discovery. And the reason is quite subtle. The reason is that if you have three coordinate patches, imagine I have x, x prime, and x double prime. Okay? So I can change coordinates from x to x prime. And then I can change from x prime to x double prime. Or I can go directly from x to x double prime. And I better get the same answer. Right? If this picture means anything at all, it should be that going in two steps is the same as going in one. And that is called, that has a name, that property. That is called the compatibility condition. And whenever you have this picture of coordinate charts covering a manifold in any context, this is an absolutely crucial condition. That when I change coordinates, if I have three systems of coordinates and I change them, two of them, that should be equivalent to the other one. That condition is enough to make the whole thing consistent. You see, because if I change five different coordinate systems and I want to show it's equivalent to the end result, well, I can always get rid of one using this operation. So now it becomes four. And one again, it becomes three, and one again, it becomes two, and then finally I show they're all equal. So this, showing that two coordinate system changes are equivalent to one, is critical to showing the whole thing is compatible. And the beautiful thing about this connection that Riemann defined is that it satisfies this property. That I can change from one coordinate system to another, and the answer I get is exactly the same as if I change from the first to the last. Okay, and that's proven in that little blue book.
Question.
Yeah, it's just algebra.
Do we assume that this is symmetric in the two lower
instances? No, I've assumed nothing. So next time we'll talk about the symmetry properties of this guy. You see, I was rather careful when I told you to define this derivative. The derivative index goes last on the gamma. Now, that statement only means anything if there is a difference between these two. So always put it last. there are various versions of this connection. One of them is called the Christoffel symbol. Christoffel symbol is only the symmetric part of this matrix. And Einstein, in fact, assumed that this was symmetric. But there's no need to do that. There's a symmetric part, which is the Christoffel symbol, and there's the anti-symmetric part, which is the torsion. And in fact, in the real world, we know there is torsion. Okay, so actually Einstein was wrong. Because, well, that's a little bit of a harsh statement. In fact, it's an unjustified statement. Einstein assumed that torsion was zero. However, there are certain theories which, within the framework of physics Einstein described, there's no reason to set the torsion zero. Torsion is a tensor. You see, by the way, we'll do this a little bit later, but you can see immediately from this transformation law, this quantity is symmetric under nu and rho, right? Because partial derivatives commute. It's one of the basic properties of partial derivatives. They commute. So this is symmetric. So if I take the anti-symmetric part of gamma, actually, this part in the transformation will cancel. So the anti-symmetric part of gamma is a tensor. It's called a torsion tensor. Now, within the context of Einstein's description of gravity, he just had this tensor floating around, which is the torsion, anti-symmetric part of this. What do I do with it? So he just set it zero. He didn't want to worry about it, so he just set it zero, assume it's zero. Within more, more constrained theories, like supergravity. So in supergravity, you have fermions and gauge fields and gravity. And when you work out the equations of motion, there is no arbitrariness. You can't just simply add torsion or not add torsion. It would spoil supersymmetry. So there, in that frame, it's totally constrained. And what you discover in that framework is the torsion is definitely not zero. Torsion has to be non-zero, and the source of the torsion are the fermion fields, the spinning fields in nature source the torsion. Okay, it's tiny in magnitude, but I would say we have every reason to expect it is not zero. But it's interesting. I mean, Bill Unruh is one of our distinguished research chairs. You know, he visits from time to time, and he's absolutely adamant that torsion must be zero. And so I say, why do you think it's zero? So he says, because it's the simplest assumption that it's zero. But you see, there's no symmetry or other profound theoretical reason which forces it to be zero. And in fact, in theories which do have higher principles, which constrain things, it's not zero. So I fully expect the torsion to be not zero. So,
But how can I think about the torsionless space-time or space geometrically? How does it look like?
We'll come to this later. One of the properties of the connection is it determines how things travel through the space. So they will follow an equation called a geodesic equation, which is governed by this quantity. Now, if there is torsion, then the angle between two vectors, so if you have a particle, say two particles with spins, and they're traveling through space-time. If you have no torsion, the angle between those two spins will remain the same. If there is torsion, the angle will change. So there's a real physical effect.
So could you experimentally then check it?
Sorry. Yes, absolutely. So this is something.
Has it been checked?
Yeah, but not. You see, the trouble is that the expected magnitude of it is really tiny, and it's not been checked very well. So, yeah, it's an very interesting thing to think about. Almost no work has been done on this, constraining the torsion. But from a logical point of view, there's no reason why it isn't there. And in fact, as I said, there are good reasons to expect it should be there. Okay.